So good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming in great numbers to this speakers series event organized by the Institute for Sustainability in Engineering and Design. Our talk today deals with a topic that is one of the foremost topics in the Institute mandate, which is sustaining the planet. And it's got a few subtitles, like the one you have there, energy independence and carbon neutral, and I have another one, and there's another one, the Green Industrial Revolution. Our speaker today is Dr. Woodrow Clark, and he will be introduced by Ram Panda, which is one of the main stakeholders in the Institute activities. Ram Panda.
Good afternoon, everyone. As Yeza introduced me, I'm very much of an interested party like all of you are, and it's good to see that we still have a huge number of believers in the Green Revolution. As you know, the talk is far ahead of the walk in this subject, and perhaps one day we'll have 300 here than the number we have. And I have the distinct pleasure of introducing to you Dr. Woodrow Clark. He's a qualitative economist and managing director of Clark Strategic Partners. His major clients have included Energy Advisor, LA Community College District, Renewable Energy Advisor for Paramount Studios in the solar and renewable systems area, and other companies. As senior foreign energy advisor for the Asian Development Bank, he dealt with projects in Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region, People's Republic of China. He also served as the Renewable Energy, Emerging Technology, and Finance Advisor to the Governor of California during the state's energy crisis from 2000 to 2003. And of course, this crisis is still continuing everywhere. He now teaches and creates sustainable development programs at universities. He is Green Advisor to the State of California Workforce Investment Board and to the Producers Guild of America. His co-authored book, Agile Energy Systems, Global Solutions to the California Energy Crisis, which came out in 2004, has become a classic in energy economics and public planning. His last books include Qualitative Economics Toward a Science of Economics from 2008, Sustainable Communities 2009, Sustainable Communities Design Handbook 2010, and the Third Industrial Revolution 2011. In 2007, Dr. Clark was a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for his contributions to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from 1995 to 2000. As he puts it, I present the sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. Of course, most of us have seen it, I think. From over decades of work on sustainable development to mitigate climate change. I present to you Dr. Clark.
Thank you. That's great, thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? All right, now if I move over here, can you hear me all right? The microphone, you're all right? Okay. I have a tendency to like to walk around an audience. Part of the reason is that those of you who are texting or on your iPads, I usually have to put them away and pay attention to the talk, you know? You can tell I'm a professor from that, right? Everybody? All right. But I do like to try to engage everybody in the talk and in the discussion that hopefully will come afterwards, and we'll be able to have a good dialogue. I want to thank the Institute, and I want to... Whoops. Is this all right? I can see we're having an adjustment. I want to thank everybody, though, for inviting me. And, oh, okay. I moved to this side. And it's an honor to be here today. And what I'll try to do is go through a series of slides, which I know will be available online, and this talk will also be available as well. So that will allow all of you to be able to see everything in some detail later. What I'm intending to do is basically outline some ideas which I think will be very interesting to most of you in the audience, and I hope will be stimulating enough for some further dialogue as well. So you'll see at the end contact information for me, how you can reach me by email or whatever, okay? To start off with, though, I wanted to make one other comment in addition to the introduction, which were fantastic. And that is simply to say that today I'm also teaching and working at UCLA on a part-time basis on purpose what is called Cross-Disciplinary Scholars in Science and Technology. That program is designed specifically to allow, for lack of a better word, people between the disciplines to interact and work together. And by doing that, that means that you're able to, you're able to have people who are in, let's say, physics talk to people who are in economics. And those of you who are in physics or in engineering or chemistry say to yourselves, that's impossible. We're two different worlds, two different languages, right? What we need to do is have more of a dialogue interaction between the disciplines, because with that, we're going to be able to solve problems in a way that we don't have to say, well, I don't know what the costs are. And I'll say, well, I don't know if the technology is ready yet. We have to have this kind of a dialogue, and one of the things I'm really happy to be here for is to encourage that. And I hope in the future you have an audience full of a couple hundred people, and it's overflowing or whatever. Hopefully we'll have some more discussions about that and follow up. So what I'm going to do is show you some slides, and I often refer to myself sometimes as a translator between the sciences and the social sciences, okay? So hopefully we'll go into that. I have a book coming out soon in October called The Next Economics, and that discusses some of these kinds of issues in economics, but also how economics, which is not a science. I should have get an applause from a lot of people in science here. Yeah, right, Dr. Clark, you're right. I go into audiences of economists and I say that and they go, oh, get that man out of here. You know, but the fact is, economics is not a science. And so one of my intentions with this book is to start talking about how do you make economics a science. That leads to sociology, anthropology, urban planning, a series of other areas as well. So with that context in mind, that's what I'll be talking about this evening. And hopefully we'll have some dialogue and follow up with all of that. I'm not telling you, oh, go buy my book and I'll come back and do a book signing sometime. No, no, I just wanted to be aware of the fact there is more to what I'll be talking about today, some of which we'll get into. Okay? So let's go through the slides. I thought it might be a good place to start is to quote Giza on this, is that the Institute is a two-pronged mandate. It has a two-pronged mandate to embed a culture of sustainability in the Faculty of Engineering and across McGill, and to work with academic, industry, and government partners to promote sustainable principles and practices. I am quoting basically what this program's about. It's exactly the same kind of thing that I'm working on in the United States and other parts of the world to get these disciplinary areas instead of in a kind of a tunnel vision, but to start working together in a partnership and collaborative way. So with that in mind, let's get into some of the details. The first is the world is round. For most economists that I know, the world is flat. One in particular has made this into an actual topic of a book, although he's now changing the title or the content and the orientation and is now seeing the world in more of a round fashion. But I want to make that very clear, that this is the way economics works. You make a statement, it becomes very politicized, and it's not any science to it. And what you have to do is look at, okay, what is being talked about? Well, we know the world is round, not just because of economics, because what happens in Europe has an impact in our Wall Street or over in Asia and other places. We also know that the global recession that is still going on started in 2008, in the fall of 2008 on Wall Street. I can name the people involved who started it. But the fact is, it's still happening, and it's happening throughout the world. It probably has some impact here in Canada and here on the campus. The other part of it is the world is round because of climate change. What happens in one part of the world has an impact in other parts of the world. It's not unusual that that is going on, is becoming more dramatic these days. So we have to look at how you look at the world and how you solve the problems that the world is now confronting. So solving the problem can start or work here in Montreal and in McGill, but it also can start in California, it can start in China, it can start in India, it can start in South America, other parts of the world. We all have to work on this together. And it's not a matter of saying, okay, I'll wait till someone else solves the problems, everything will be fine. So when we have a tsunami, for example, in Japan, and a nuclear power plant in Fukushima that blows up basically because of that, we in California have now been experiencing some of the repercussions of that on our coastal areas. In Northern California just recently, a large chunk of concrete from Japan, from that facility, washed ashore. You have a huge piece of concrete from the building going across the Pacific Ocean. That's just one simple example. There's lots of others. So what does all of this mean? It means that we have to be careful in what we're doing in all of our communities because it has a dramatic impact around the world. So if you take this into account, what's going on today, and I'll go through this fairly quickly because I think most of you in the scientific community are very aware of this. What's going on today in the North Pole in terms of climate change is very dramatic. I used to live and work in Denmark, and Greenland was actually, and still is, if you will, a colony of the Danes. And the changes that are going on there are astronomical. Greenland is, a quick footnote, I got in an argument with a lawyer, environmental lawyer in Los Angeles about this. He said, Greenland used to be green, so now all the ice is disappearing, so it'll be green again. Now I said to myself, now the name Greenland, I don't remember when I was in Denmark, that's what Greenland meant. And so I looked it up and checked with two of my friends in Denmark, and they said, no, the actual name of the country in Danish was ground, but had nothing to do with being green. It was interpreted in the English language as Greenland. It did not mean that that country or that area was ever green, per se. And so now what's going on in the world is changing, and the ice is melting, so it's going to go be green again. No, that's not the case at all. And the Danes have controlled that area for 200 years. So they should know better, I think, than my friend who's a lawyer in Los Angeles, correct? So, and I'm not picking, anyone here a lawyer? Maybe I should start with that. Anyone? I'm not picking on attorneys, by the way. I tend to do that sometimes, but I'm not. Some of my best friends are lawyers. But what I'm getting at is we have to understand what's happening in the world. And in fact, Greenland is losing a lot of its ice. And it's been is a major result from actually global warming and climate change, which is hitting Greenland as it is the rest of the world. Now let's take a look at your neighbors to the south. I would assume that this kind of a chart is also applicable to here in Canada, where you are experiencing some of the worst weather that you've ever seen, frankly, every year. I am told that the weather here is very nice, and this September is very warm, and people are out in the cafes, but I'm not sure this is the usual kind of weather that you have. When I left California in Los Angeles, I expected to come here and it'd be a bit cooler. So consequently, I didn't bring my shorts, and I didn't bring my, you know, T-shirts and stuff, and I brought warmer clothes, thinking that I'd have a bit, if you will, need to have some warmer clothes to wear. And what I found is the weather here is very similar to what I left in California. It's both hot and humid, and I assume different than what you normally have this time mid-September. I may be wrong, but if I'm right about it, we are beginning to see climate change in the northern hemisphere, in both the United States and Canada, and certainly below us in Central America and South America. We see it in the Caribbean, and we also see it in the tsunamis that we're having now on the Pacific Ocean side. We're having an enormous amount of new hurricanes coming to particularly the Gulf of Mexico and through the United States in tornadoes. The numbers of people who have been killed in the last few years has way beyond anything that's ever been seen before. And what I'm saying to all of you is, again, these are climate issues, and the climate issues are getting worse, not better. What do we do about it here? What do we do about it in America and other parts of the world? It's something that we have to pay a great deal of attention to. Now, I want to come to one of the other issues, and this is an issue I might get in some debate with some of you about, and I'd like you, if you have some questions, maybe leave it to the end because you may have a disagreement. But this is a chart from the U.S. Department of Energy. It came out about 10 years ago. And the chart basically shows oil having 40 years left, 10 years ago now, so that means 30. Natural gas, 61 years left, and now it's 51 years. And coal, 216 years. Whatever, okay, it's beyond my whatever imagination. Uranium, that's the one that's a shocker. 61 years left of uranium in the world. Now, if you go currently, today, what you will find is some of my colleagues in the energy area, particularly those people who are aware of how much oil and gas and other things are available, will say, wait a minute. Now, you got to remember, Woody, there is an enormous amount of new oil being discovered. There's shale oil. There's other kinds of areas of oil and gas, natural gas. And what we're finding is we're going to be very you know, able to continue and build based on the reserves that we have found in the last few years. This is where I take very serious disagreement with people who make that argument, because from my perspective, that's not a good thing to do. We have to begin to move away from that and off of our dependency on fossil fuels. Now, the title of my talk, and we decided to do this several months ago, on energy independence, it's interesting, because my work in this area has meant to look at renewable energy, and we're now seeing in the United States, one of the candidates for president is talking about how America needs to be energy independent. And do you know what he means by that? Go dig for more oil offshore in America, go for the shale oil, pipe it down from Alberta, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I take great exception to that. That's simply an excuse to not do the right thing, which is to stop our polluting of the air and the environment and destroying our land. And I say that because there may be one or two of you in the audience who might disagree with it. But then look at the chart. This is called from the U.S. Department of Energy. I used to be at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I was there for about 10 years in the 1990s. And I probably should have said this when I started. And I was the only economist business person in 8,300 people. We had the largest number of physicists in any one location in the world at one time, 1,347. All right, but I was the only business person because I had a background in entrepreneurship and economics. And they wanted me to come there to help work in technology transfer. I changed it to technology commercialization. And for the lawyers in the group, the reason was because the lawyers were the barrier. You don't do technology transfer before you go through the legal stuff that lasts 3 or 4 years. Meanwhile, the technology is old news. So we worked on changing that. But the point I'm trying to make is at Livermore Lab, what I learned about was these spaghetti charts, graphs. And what's interesting is, if you look at these charts very carefully, what you will see in effect is how much energy is being used and where it's coming from, and then how that has an impact, and it will have an impact on how it's used. So, for example, over here, not too much in nuclear power, but still some. You have natural gas, which is growing, high dependency on coal, and also then, of course, oil and other petroleum. Used in residential, industrial, and transportation, and their loss is incredible amount, and this is how much is actually being used. This is tracked on an annual basis with the U.S. Department of Energy. But it's not just the United States. They now have charts and graphs tracking this as well in other parts of the world. So, for example, I edited it out. I have a chart like this for China. And what I wanted to show all of you is in China, this factor here is double. The dependency the Chinese have on coal is double. It's growing in the nuclear power area, and they're now importing oil from other parts of the world. Natural gas is coming from Russia. Now imagine that, having a pipeline going to northern China of natural gas coming from Russia. Anybody know what the Russians... If anyone's Russian in here, I apologize. But anyone know what the Russians did a few years ago with their resources of supplying fuel to Europe? They turned it off. Oh, they turned it off. Why? They wanted more money. And by the way, those pipelines went through the Ukraine. I work with people in the Ukraine, so I know what happened as a result of that. A change in government and a few other things. But the fact of the matter is, having those kinds of dependencies in China, because of what they're doing in the spaghetti chart fashion, has a big impact on their environment and what they're doing to try to improve their economy. The issue, though, is why would China have more coal and also get other resources from other parts of the world when they should do something about renewable energy? And that's one of my points I want to make today. That's exactly what they're doing. When I did my report on Inner Mongolia 7 years ago for the Asian Development Bank, that's what we were looking at. In Inner Mongolia, second largest coal-producing region in China, the Chinese wanted to do how to eliminate or reduce their dependency on coal. They also make the region more sustainable, and that's what they've done. There's now got wind turbine farms and solar farms all over Inner Mongolia and other parts of China. So anyway, what does that mean in terms of the United States? Well, we were discussing a little bit of this before, but this is a chart from a group called NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory. They're located in Colorado, right about here in Golden. And this chart actually shows the potential for wind offshore in the United States. That's what this is, offshore wind. Now, it wasn't until, I think it was about 5 years ago, that they started doing this. They never looked at, they looked at wind and solar and geothermal biomass in the United States in different regions, but they never looked at it in terms of offshore wind. Now, the issue was, what kind of wind power could actually be installed offshore in different regions of the United States that would help provide it with renewable energy? And that was one of the reasons I and others were encouraging NREL to start doing this, because it was the discovery there was an incredible kind of capacity and possibilities. Now, I can get into weather and problems and the rest of it, but the fact of the matter is it's an opportunity in Northern Europe. They have a lot of wind offshore, and they have also a lot of solar that's installed, particularly in Germany. So in areas where it can work and be economic and feasible, it is a very strong decision to do that. So then you go to the intellectual property that's involved with some of these kinds of issues and technology. Now, I mentioned before, and I asked if there were attorneys in the room, and you know, I noticed one woman just left. But what I wanted to bring up, though, is that intellectual property is very important, because let's take, for example, the whole notion of wind power offshore. Well, that's going to you've got to have the technology, you've got to have the turbines, you have to understand how that's going to work, it's got to be transferred and commercialized, etc. Now, one of the issues that I've done or raised in the recent book that I have on the next economics is how to make economics more scientific. And one of my suggestions has been to have a look at linguistics. When you study linguistics, particularly coming from Noam Chomsky and others at MIT, you can see that they've begun to make linguistics over the last 3 or 4 decades into a science. The next part of it I looked at was this, intellectual property. How can you have intellectual property in economics? Where does it exist? How does it exist? Well, you publish a book or a paper, that's a copyright, right? Okay. Well, some colleagues of mine and I decided that they have a company that I'm on the board of called Neuralis. They have LED lights. And we came up with an economic, if you will, model on how to get LED lights into buildings all over the world. And the model is very simple. They were free. Not only were they free, but it also reduced a major cost to all these facilities and homes of energy, because obviously LED lights do not use that kind of energy. My two colleagues, both electrical engineers, and I decided, we need to put together a patent on that idea. Is everybody with me? Economics having patents. That strike you as, oh my God, what? We did it. We filed a patent. The patent is pending. There may be some problem with it. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, if you have a way to get light bulbs, one example, and make it economical, in other words, almost free, the cost of it is coming really from the savings from your energy and your electric bill, then you've got a model that's very interesting and something that is worth patenting. And so what we're trying to do is file the patent, or have filed the patent, on this process. And it's a very interesting approach to how and where intellectual property is important. Now, as you all know, intellectual property is important for other reasons, too. This gentleman, about a year ago, he's now passed away. There are many people who claim that he's, you know, probably the intellectual, if not the leader in the world, or was the leader in the world in innovation and technology. His company, called Apple, is now, I think, the worth more than any other company has ever been in terms of its value in the stock market and other places. I used to live and work in Northern California in the Silicon Valley area, and I had run across him a few times, and certainly a lot of people at Apple over the years. And what was interesting to me about what he did is he took an idea, and I don't know whether all of you are familiar with how Apple Computer first started, but it was basically an idea coming from a very big company that at one point had massive computer systems, and they were, you know, in big buildings, and they had developed in Silicon Valley a software technology to which you were able to take all of the, if you will, components of that computer system and put it into a small computer that fit on your table or desk. And I'll never forget the story from the research person that sold him the intellectual property for that. Was basically at one point they were going to take this technology, the company that developed it, and throw it away. they didn't care about it. It didn't fit their current economic and, if you will, company profile, what their purpose was. So Steve Jobs literally raised his hand in a meeting and said, let's see, can I take that? And so he, with his business partner, Wozniak, they actually developed the Apple computer from that. In other words, what somebody else saw as not meeting their business model at the time, he saw as something that had some applications for the future. Is there anyone in this room who does not have a personal computer or a laptop computer? Anyone? If someone raises your hand, see me. I'll sell you a few, okay? I mean, it's ridiculous. We all have them. But do some of you have your, you know, have hair gray like mine, remember the days when it was a big change going from a centralized computer to a personalized one. Now to the point where we carry them around called an iPad. So what the point of his, if you will, vision was really that, to see what was important, to take control of it, and then to make it commercial. Now some of you may not know about another part of this man's life. And when at Apple Computer in the late 1980s, they went through a process after going public where he even helped bring in the former CEO of Pepsi-Cola from New York, and that guy got rid of Steve Jobs, forced him out. Well, Steve Jobs is not the kind of person to sit around twiddling his thumbs because he has, you know, $15, $20 million in the bank from that. No, what he did is he formed a company called Pixar. Anybody here know that company? Were you all aware that he was the founder? That company is the one that is named after me, right? You all know about the Toy Story? Woody's the main character? That's me, right? But the point I'm trying to make is what was going on is, again, here's a very creative person who saw the value in some ideas and the value of other people around him in a totally different area. It had nothing to do with computers. And that group also started in Richmond, California, Northern California near San Francisco and Berkeley, Pixar, and now is located in a town called Emeryville, very close to Berkeley. And that company is now, anyone know? Owned by, sold to? Mickey Mouse. I'm sorry about it, Donald Duck. No, Disney. Disney bought it. And it's when he was still alive. That's what, that happened not too long ago, about 4 or 5 years ago. So my point in all of this is you can have people with this kind of vision and taking, if you will, a different approach or look at the world and coming up with incredible kinds of opportunities. And that point is something we have to encourage among all of you, the students, the faculty, and other alums, you know, from the school in engineering and sciences. We also have to do it, and make this point very clear too, Steve Jobs was not an engineer. Bill Gates was not an engineer. But their business partners were. Paul Allen, Henry Wozniak. Both of them were trained engineers. So that relationship was also rather critical and rather important. Now, there are books written, particularly since Steve Jobs died, about, well, he was difficult to work with, this, that, and the other thing. Okay, fine. I don't know probably anybody in this room who's easy to work with. But anyway, that's all right. We all have our problems, and we have our intricacies. That's fine. But the point I'm trying to make is how important ideas are and how to make them into a good venture, profitable ventures. So then I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the history of energy economics. And I show this slide because I want to be very clear about one critical point. In this slide, you have a picture here of a gas station, if you will, regular subsidies, then premium price gouging, and, you know, from the oil companies or whatever. And who pays for it all in the end? We do. We, the consumers. I make this point because when I hear people, and I hear a lot of it today, who say, if you're going to start a new business or do something, you should do it. You should go find the money and talk to your mother-in-law, get a credit card that's endless, whatever, you know, both of which I don't recommend. But what this really says is that, in part, governments have a critical role in starting new ventures. So when I hear someone who says, we can't do this, it's too expensive. And I say, well, how do you think oil and gas were first developed? From the governments. They provided the land, the transportation, the other system. We had a train going from the East Coast to the West Coast of the United States, and it was done to carry some of these products. It wasn't because we had a lot of tourists. This is back 200 years ago. No. You had the same kind of development of transportation systems like that here in Canada. The point I'm trying to make here is to say that everything should be done by the private sector is a misstatement. It's also an economic fallacy. The notion of the invisible hand does not exist. It never did. I'll back up. It's a myth. I'll back up further. It's wrong. That's why I wrote a book called The Next Economics, because that paradigm shift is critical. Now, why and where did I get involved with some of this stuff? Anybody hear of this company? Okay, now remember, I refer to myself as a qualitative economist. The reason is, when I was in state government working for the governor of California in the year 2000, I was actually in Denmark, I came back to work for him. We were getting numbers coming to us from not just this company, but a few others. Ready? 1 + 1 = 7. And this is typical of me. I raised my hands. I'll never forget this. I was in a room of people in the governor's office. 1 + 1. How did that happen? And then someone said, really, it's been validated by a CPA firm, Anderson & Anderson. So I'm supposed to be quiet? You can tell I'm not a quiet person. No, I started asking more questions. Now I got the lawyers involved. I said, wait a second. What's going on here? And what we found out is this company and others were manipulating the market, moving numbers around, turning off, if you will, supply systems or having to do with so-called maintenance. And in fact, that's how they're justifying those numbers. But the reality of it is, it's not true. 1 + 1 doesn't = 7. It raises questions about the numbers. It certainly raises questions about the plus sign and the equal signs and everything else. And the point is, too many people often believe what they were given, especially when it went through a CPA firm, because it was validated, right? Wrong. So our role is to ask the questions and see what's going on. And the fact is, we have today, and by the way, I'm very proud of the fact that most of the people who are heading this company are now in jail or trying to appeal or they've been in jail for whatever. But the other part of it is, what I'm really disturbed by is the people who work for this company lost their retirement and their other kinds of savings because of what happened in the collapse of it. What it signifies is what we have to look out for in the future about the manipulation of economics and markets through using numbers and using different kinds of explanations that are really invalid. So this gets me to, what is this green economic revolution? There's a green industrial revolution. What does the economic one mean? Well, I'm one of these people who likes The Economist because it's kind of like me watching in America a television news program called Fox News. Anybody ever hear of Fox News? I call it Fox propaganda because it's not news. It's kind of like in Los Angeles when we have a local news station that says breaking news. And breaking news means in Los Angeles a helicopter is following a car and it's being chased by police cars. Now, to me, that's not news. That's somebody, getting a job flying a helicopter. But that's not what I think, need to know what's going on in the world by breaking news. Same thing with Fox News. It's not news. It's propaganda based on their particular opinions. And what's interesting to me is The Economist is somewhat the same way, but at least they're more open, I think, to at least talking about ideas. So let me go, not necessarily in order of importance, but this special issue of The Economist came out in July 2009. Now, those of you who either know or have some religious background know that this is a Bible, and it's melting. That's not good. And it says modern economic theory. What happened before, let's say 9 months before July 2009? Anybody know? We had an economic crisis hit the world in the September before that, 2008. Well, what's interesting is this issue came out in the summer. Now, if you are involved with the mass media or published journals or articles or stuff, you know that most people do not read things in the summertime. They're on holiday or vacation. So very few people read this special issue, because in the special issue they were saying that the economic theories that have been proposed in the last 30 to 40 years, going back to Milton Friedman and some others, have been wrong. The only response that they published as a result of this special issue came from two places. One was the University of Chicago's dean, the School of Economics, and he argued that, no, economics is right, it's changed, it's doing that. And one of the things that it's changing to is we are now having psychological economics. What does that mean? Remember, I'm a qualitative economist. What does psychological economics mean? And the answer to that is, we do surveys. So, again, not science, but specifically they're getting opinions from surveys, plus or minus a 2 to 3%, you know, margin of error. And that's what modern economics is all about, and it's still valid that the argument went from the University of Chicago people. In fact, that's wrong, because that's what the economist was saying, is that economics was not able to, remember this is important, predict the economic collapse that happened the fall before. All of you who are scientists in this room know that if you can't have scientific evidence that predicts something, it's not a science. And that's exactly what the problem was in this particular case. So you had the economist criticizing its field, and it grew into more and more people started reading that summer issue as the fall came, and someone would say to me, oh, I haven't read that. I said, well, do you want me to send you the articles in it? Because I had it electronically. And I was doing that, and people said, oh, I got to read that. So they're getting it off their shelf, or they're dusting it off of the trash barrel that they had it in. So it became more and more of a topic. Then after that, all of that happened, just recently, the economist came out, I think it was earlier this year, The Rise of State Capitalism and I'm an anti-smoker, so right away I didn't like this, but of course it's with Lenin, you know. So, okay, Rise of State Capitalism. Their argument was, well, this looks negative. Their argument was, in that special issue, that in effect, the state capitalism that has started in China, Brazil, and some other countries has turned those emerging economies into very advanced economies. So, in a way, the whole change here, it started from re-looking at the paradigm of the old economics based on Adam Smith and neoclassical economics, was moving very rapidly into something that was different and successful. Of course, from this, it looks very negative, but in the articles inside were different. Then it comes and says, okay, from all of this is like 2 or 3 months ago, we now have a third industrial revolution, meaning that, and some colleagues of mine and I have written about this, there's now a first industrial revolution, a second, now we're into a third one. I argue it's a green industrial revolution because I think that's where the economy is going, so that communities and countries can be energy independent based on green technologies. When I'm being green, renewable energy and primarily, storage devices, hybrid systems, whole series of things that are causing a very strong growth. That's the kind of thing that's happening, and it's different than what the economist was coming to their conclusion. But it was indicating that they were aware that there was a change going on. And I would predict, you can write this down if you want, in the next 6 to 8 months, the economist is going to come out with something about the green industrial revolution. Because they're going to get, oh, there is something going on here. So I say that to you because some of the solutions that have come about in economics in terms of how we stop climate change is by what is called a cap and trade program. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. A couple of you, maybe? Cap and trade? Okay. Cap and trade, and I won't go through all the details, simply means that if you are a company or a group that's causing pollution, that what you can do is trade or buy credits and that therefore be able to have a reduction in what your responsibility is really for reducing your own pollution. So there are companies are trading this, there's auctions on it and other things. My view of it is, as you can see, and this is the French word, I think, isn't it? Greed? No, I'm kidding. The point is, it's greed. Cap and trade is nothing more than greed. It's similar to what we experienced in the United States with deregulation of energy, where you have people using the auction or the concept of trading services in order to make money. The problem with that is, again, is defining what you're trading, whether it's actually eliminating or stopping emissions and climate problems, and whether it's solving the problem, because it's not. It's not doing any of those things. So I say that to you because, again, this is kind of illustrating what all of it is. People are supporting the cap and trade because they can see the money flowing their way. And, in fact, I know some of the people who have founded some of the organizations that are now advocating this, including the state of California. And they personally have made a lot of money, but the systems have not worked. I can name names and places at some other time privately. But my point to all of you is it's not a solution. It's, in other words, another kind of mechanism to kind of, if you will, manipulate the solutions that are available. So one other thing. This just came out recently in The Economist. I don't know whether people read it or not, but this is called Asia's Next Revolution. And I got kind of a kick out of this in a way from the picture. But also inside, they're talking about some of the issues that we're looking at here in the Western world particularly I know in the United States, about what is the role of government, how is it going to change, what's the role of workers, what is health issues and education, what's going to happen in pensions and retirement. All those kinds of issues are things that are being discussed all over the world. We're not alone. But, and it's a big but, in this particular issue of The Economist, they do talk about where it has actually succeeded. Again, in many places in Asia, hence the picture from all the Asian children. They cite different examples, and I think it's the kind of thing, again, the next economics is really all about. So if you look at some of the solutions, you know, and I'm sure many of you are aware, that China is actually very much on the radar screen and doing incredibly well in terms of its own GDP and economic development. Here it is, here rapidly approaching and going probably estimated above other Asian countries in the very near future. Now, with that comes China's distinction as being the number one carbon polluter in the world. They have now taken that distinction from we Americans. Now, per capita, they've got 1.3 billion people. In America, we have roughly 400,000 people. That's, you know, something different. But in terms of the amount of pollution that's coming in from different kinds of manufacturing and technologies and use of energy, China has now taken that distinction. It's something they're well aware of, and as I'll point out, doing something about. Now, let's start with what they're doing about it. If you look at this chart of China, one thing you'll see is that the population is shifting more and more to the eastern regions from the western regions. China now has its 12th five-year plan. It was implemented about a little over a year ago, March of 2011. In that plan, it specifically says one of the points is that they are going to have renewable energy. It's going to be focused towards making their communities sustainable. And what, guess what? They're putting trillions of U.S. dollar equivalent into doing that. And they're doing it. Now, I tell you that because I don't know whether the university here or the city in Montreal or let alone the country of Canada, but I certainly know that it's not true in the United States. We don't have a plan for anything. It's ridiculous. I made that statement in one of my books that came out about 4 years ago. And the chairman of the Federal Energy Reserve Commission, the overseer of all the energy systems in the United States, was reading my book. We were talking about it. And he says, this is the first sentence in the concluding paragraph, that the United States does not have an energy plan. He says to me, Woody, that is so true. It's absolutely insane. We don't know what we're doing. Now, I put that back to all of you. Many of you have families. Some of you have businesses. Do you have a plan for what you do? I think so. At least I hope so, at least to some extent. But we don't do it as a nation or in terms of our society, particularly in the United States. And it's actually horrible, the results. I can go on about that. But in China, they have them. And they're getting results. One of the results is they're having more and more wind farms built in this area. And they've got an actual part of their program is to now try to get people away from going to the eastern areas and moving west out in the western regions of China. And they've set up mass transit, high-speed rail trains, and other things to be able to encourage that throughout that whole region. This gets to some of the intricacies of it. And some of you are most of you are in science and will know this. This looks at the national grid plan in about 2020 in China, how it is now and then how it's improving. You'll see all this detail later, and I'm sorry this is so small on this chart, but you'll be able to see all this at another time. The point is to try to get it more coordinated, to make it much, if you will, smarter, and to be able to use the technologies of today to really get into a green industrial revolution. And part of what they're doing is using things like this. I mentioned before the LED bulb. Well, I think many of you are familiar with the fact that this is a bulb that's very common and used and talked about today for environmental purposes, right? Are you all aware how dangerous those bulbs are? You cannot recycle them. The mercury in them is dangerous. You have an LED bulb like this, and this is the one that we have the economic patent pending for, this LED bulb. It doesn't have that kind of problem. It doesn't have that kind of technology to it. And specifically, by the way, is one of the things that is now in California and sort of in the American government legislation was passed about a year ago, less than a year ago, is that these bulbs are now being discouraged from being bought. They're not prohibited, they're discouraged. And in fact, these bulbs are much more being encouraged. You have more companies are growing in this area, and the companies that were selling these bulbs are changing dramatically on what their economic models are. So you have Philips and all the major companies doing that as I speak. They resisted, but now they know that they need to change. So then you look at Canada. Everyone in the room familiar with Alberta? What's going on in Alberta? Do I need to say anything, or do you want to hear a comment from an American about it? What? Stop. Right there. Right here. You know why? Because, I'll get back to this. Oh, I got the picture. I have pictures of the land area in Alberta. It is horrible. And this comes from colleagues and friends of mine who have done research and work. And I know very well that that environment's being destroyed, and probably forever, in terms of what can happen, not just in a small region, but thousands of miles in this whole area in the tar sands. The other part of it, that why I think it needs to be stopped, is because of the stupidity, frankly, of having these pipelines through the United States, or let alone through Canada. There are discussions, as some of you well know, of doing it into Vancouver, and therefore having to get the oil from this ship to other parts of the world, particularly China. It needs to stop. That's all there is to it. No. It's not cheaper. And I remember when I was at Livermore Lab 20 years ago, we talked about this. In tar sands, there's other parts in the United States that are, one day maybe this will become cheaper than what we're paying for a barrel of oil. That's not the point. Oil, tar sands, natural gas, all that stuff is dangerous. If we invest in it and put the kind of resources in it that we're seeing happen today, we have what in economics we call stranded costs. It means you pay for something today, but you're still paying the debt on that something today for the next 30 or 40 years. Which means myself and a few other people in the room are gray hair. Hey, it's out of our lifetime. But for you younger people, we are giving you something that's a disaster. We're putting it on your plate, not only to pay for, but ruin your atmosphere and your pollution and your environment. That's not right. It's incorrect, totally. Let's talk about hydraulic fracturing. Anybody know about this? A few people? A friend of mine is chair of a California State Government Oversight Committee on looking at fracturing. And we haven't talked about this directly yet, but I know we will. We have a conference call coming up later this week, coming week. And his committee is looking at how to make fracturing safe, how to monitor it, how to regulate it, how to be sure it's okay. My answer to this one is the same. Wrong. I remember when we were doing research again at Livermore Lab on fracturing, and we had systems and working with people in Europe, particularly in Norway, where they were doing some of this underwater as well as on land, because what they were trying to do is obviously get more oil. And the fact was that nobody could guarantee anything in terms of not only the technology, but also in terms of the safety. Today, given, you know, we've just celebrated the 10th anniversary of 9/11 in the United States, and I know the world is as well here in Canada, the issue here is not to do this kind of thing because of what dangers are going to cause and the problems that are still unknown. Nonetheless, there are people who are pushing for it. Now, this is my favorite example. It's called a case study. And you're right. I was not around in 1903 when this car was invented. You're right. Absolutely. You're totally right. Okay, my hair is gray, but not that gray, all right? But the fact is, the hybrid car was invented in Germany over 100 years ago. Doesn't that shock some of you? Oh, let's do it this way. How many of you drive a hybrid car?
Who?
Two? All right, I have a table back here for the rest of you. You can sign up for it. We'll get the car for you next week, okay? How about an electric car? Anybody drive an electric car? All electric car? One? One? Well, listen, folks, we have to have a talk, okay? We got to talk about this. You got to do something about this. You folks are all engineers and scientists. You know what I'm talking about, right? Then you need to ask me the question, where's electricity coming from my hybrid car, right? Right? Where's it coming from my all-electric car? Well, you got to be sure it comes from, what?
We're into bicycles.
Bicycles. Oh, well, okay. How many ride bicycles? All right, there we go. Oh, God, thank you for asking that question. Oh, I was going to have a heart palpitation here. Oh, my goodness. I noticed that here around the city. You've got bicycle paths and places to put your bikes and the rest of it. We don't have that in Los Angeles. Believe me, it's flatter than here. We don't have it. Anyway, But the point I'm trying to make in terms of cars is that the question of electricity and electric, where you get the electricity, is really critical, because you have to ask yourself a question, where? And obviously the best solution, and I've been working with people on this for years, is having solar or wind or water or some other kind of thing that can be electrolyzed so you can use it. What you have a problem with people who are using or want to make what are called hydrogen fuel cell cars, is to get the hydrogen. You have people who are arguing, well, let's get natural gas and reform it, and boom, we'll have a hydrogen to use for the hydrogen fuel cell car. No, you got to look for the sources. You got to look to where this energy is coming from and why it's important. This car was around over 100 years ago. Does anybody know what happened and why it didn't get commercialized and why it's taken only the last 10 or 15 years to happen? Anyone know? Yeah, and oil companies. They got control of the automobile business, and they went ahead and got rid of this car. Now, in the meanwhile, does anybody know that Henry Ford, big proponent, original Henry Ford, the Ford Motor Company, actually had a biofuel car till 1922. And then they were pressured by the oil industry to get rid of it, and instead they turned into combustion engines with gasoline. So that's the history. Okay. Fast forward. What can be done, or what's happened in this whole area? This is, again, from my friends at The Economist. Came out about 2004. Anybody know what this is symbolizing? It's from a technology some of you may know about. Anyone ever hear of regenerative braking? Okay, I hope all of you, or most of you have. Does anybody know where that technology, first of all, this is in reference to what car? Do you any know? Prius. The Toyota Prius was the first one to use regenerative braking. Now, does anybody know where the technology came from? Anybody? No. U.S. Me. Taxpayers in America. You know where it was developed? Where I worked. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, along with a couple of other labs. And in the 90s, the mid-1990s, we at Livermore Lab, I was part of the team, went to GM, Ford, and Chrysler. They said, bye-bye. We don't need your technology. We don't care if it's green. We don't care if it's good for the environment. We just want to sell cars. Of course, 10 years later or so, they all went bankrupt. But aside from that, or close to it, this technology was then sold, again, intellectual property rights. Right of refusal first goes to the United States companies. Secondly, goes to whoever raised their hand. I'll never forget it. Japanese, we'd like to get that, yes. And we sold it to the Japanese. Toyota became, until last year, the number one car company in the world because of this. That technology, from the Toyota perspective, has been developed three times over. And just 2 years ago, Toyota sold the first version of regenerative braking to Ford, when Ford could have had it 15 years earlier for almost nothing. So that's telling you something. Now, someone said in the audience about regenerative braking for trains and all. Yeah, these things have now developed from this because it makes a lot of sense. You put basically the brakes on a train, you're going to get a lot of sparks and possible power you can store in the batteries and all. And I know that's being developed now. But what I'm trying to say to all of you is this kind of technology is really important, has been around, and is now commercialized. And what we've got to do is look at that as, again, another kind of opportunity to get into sustainable communities, to begin to get transportation that's not using fossil fuels, getting people certainly on their bicycles, but also if they have to go, on a trip or take someone to the airport or something, and if they don't have a subway to the airport, they can go by a car or something that's very friendly to the environment. So this green industrial revolution, as I was mentioning throughout the first part of the talk, has, in fact, these kinds of elements to it. I'm not going to read through all of it, but I just want to highlight the issue about energy and conservation. What I refer to as agile infrastructures, meaning that you have them basically, as all of you know, being agile, you have a combination. They're basically integrated systems. So you don't just have a wind farm one place and a solar farm another, and you hope that all of them will come together in one way or the other. No, you really look at this as something that's integrated in the system itself. So that's important. You have agile systems. It could be wind and solar. It could be wind and ocean power or wave power. It could be geothermal. It could be whatever the systems are combining. The other part of it is, on these integrated systems, is that they need to be large and not just smaller ones. They're ones for homes, but also large ones. But the one I want to emphasize here to this audience in particular is we have to train people in this. It's important that we educate people not just about the different technologies, but also about the social impact, about the impact of the environment, the impact it has for economics. That's why we have to have more of this cross-disciplinary studies kind of discussions. And that's what this whole revolution's about, and it's starting and is mostly in northern parts of Europe, but also in Asia, as I've already mentioned. There are examples. Let me ask it this way. Does McGill here, since you're a really scientific community, do you have either close by or attached to the university what is referred to as a science park? Has that come up, or anyone know what a science park is? The science park is something that actually was primarily started and invented in Europe, is now really taken root in Asia, particularly in China, has still missed the road, if you will, in the United States, except some people think of Silicon Valley kind of a science park in relation to Stanford and across the bay to UC Berkeley. So they sort of see it that way. But the basic concept is this. If you're going to have people who are smart in the laboratory inventing new ideas, why can't they just walk across the street and start a business? And how do you encourage them to do that? You have facilities, you have people who are trained, you have the ability to say, look, we're going to protect in terms of your intellectual property, but also in what your economic needs are. Science parks in Europe do similar things to what I was just talking about in China. They provide money to inventors, to entrepreneurs, not debt, investment, government investment. I was talking to some of my colleagues, your colleagues here earlier today. The Danes, for example, have invented a concept which I think is very interesting called warrants, meaning, in effect, we lend you some money, but you don't have to pay us back if we get shares in your company. You have the choice, getting paid back from the company or having shares in the company. But in either case, you, the government or local society, are investing in this local business. Why? Because it creates jobs. It's good for the community. That's what science parks do. So what you have here is a picture of how this might work. This is from a German point of view in Europe. But these are an actual science park where I used to teach in Denmark. It's a place called Aalborg University. And this, when I first taught there as a Fulbright Fellow, it had this one building in 1994. This is a shot of the area more recently, like 2 years ago. You can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's how big in a decade this science park got. And in this particular science park was also the invention of the Bluetooth, along with some other groups in Europe. The Bluetooth came from this. Other industries came from it, including some relations with the wind industry. Many of you may know that the Vestas is a wind company, the biggest wind company in the world, is a Danish company, and part of their collaboration came from the science park. It's called Novi, by the way, Novi Science Park. These sustainable communities, of which I've written books and other things about, are the solution, part of this green industrial revolution, but are part of the way we begin to make these changes. So now I'm just going to give you some examples of that, and it's getting a little bit late, and I want to be sure we have time for questions. The sustainable communities are basically made up of infrastructures. What I often find is when people talk about how to solve a problem, they get focused on one thing, let's say buildings, or they get focused on another thing, cars, or they get focused on another thing, lighting. What we have to do is look at all of these issues and the infrastructures together, and because they all have an impact. So, for example, if you are, here's a community, a city, you can see they've got water and buildings, but it's also in a region that has other relationships, including with the mountains and the snow. This is a very common thing that we have to look at. Take, if you will, a broader picture and then look at the different communities and what they're doing. So one of them is, and this is from one of my books on agile energy systems, is this is the way most of the power systems work today. It was a central plant transmitting power to different places. What we need to do is begin to expand this idea by having renewable energy like wind and solar, storage devices, obviously, because wind and solar are intermittent power. The wind is not blowing all the time, and certainly the sun is not out 24 hours a day. So you have to have other ways to back it up or have the systems integrated in some way to provide power, but also in conjunction with the current utilities. I've worked with some communities where they actually see the utility is like the battery. In other words, instead of a battery here someplace on a community or in a community on a big system, they actually look at the utility as a backup in case they need the power at some point if the wind is not blowing, the sun's, of course, not shining. So then you have to look at the design of the communities. Just take a look at some of the ideas here. We've got, you know, design having to do with water and waste and also in energy. All of this is, you know, in one particular area. You hear bicycle paths, walking areas. I show this, by the way, to people in Los Angeles, and they're shocked by some. This is the truth. They're not used to trying to think about, oh, trees. Oh, that's good. Yeah. All right. Remember, Los Angeles is a desert. You know that? All right. Okay. Everyone knows a beautiful climate in some respects, but it's really a desert. You know, our water is all imported. Okay. Anyway. So you have all of these things you've got to look at in terms of how the community is developed and how it's put together. And this is a planning process. Again, planning for what you want to do and make into reality. Part of it can be, in fact, the idea of the smart grid, where you've got a larger community and you have everything is connected, but it also works for your home. What's interesting here, as I mentioned before, this is a solar panel on top of roof providing power for the home, but also as a recharging for your electric car. So you see these systems are integrated and working together. This is a community in Italy that is featured in one of my books where they're trying in the Torino area of Italy to have different kinds of solar and other systems in part in their plans for the future in this particular region. This is a hydrogen fuel cell bus. Some of you may know or heard of the company Fiat. Have you heard recently what Fiat's been doing? Fiat just bought an interest in a company called Chrysler, and Chrysler is now one-third owned by Fiat. Now, there are some Americans who don't like the invasion of Chrysler from Italy. I think it's great. I've worked with Fiat and worked in Italy because they're near Torino, and I know they're a very creative company, and they've done the kinds of environmental, if you will, green technologies that the Americans need. And so they're getting that foothold, if you will, and control of Chrysler is going to be a dramatic thing, which we're already seeing in America. I'm sure you're seeing some of that here. This is another community. This is one actually in Denmark that I am familiar with. It's a town in the western area of Denmark in the northern Jutland area. And by the year 2015, they plan to be 100% on renewable energy. 2015? My God, it's 2012. They've got 3 years left. This came out about 2 years ago. They have 3 years left. And guess what? They're over 45% on renewable energy now. They're going to make it. And that impact on the rest of Denmark is really dramatic because now the country itself has set a deadline for 2025 when the entire country of Denmark plans to be on renewable energy. No more coal, no more gas, no more oil. Gone. No nuclear power. Never had nuclear power. In Sweden, they're shutting down nuclear power plants. Everybody hear me? There's an opportunity. It's incredible. And it's happening. I'm not making this up. You can go visit these cities. I go teach there. I'm frequently back and forth to Denmark. But if you really want to come and visit someplace, anyone ever hear of this company? Google! If you haven't heard of Google, again, see me at the end. I have a table for whatever you want to buy. Google. Google has their entire campus covered with solar panels. These are all solar panels. I was landing at the airport here, and I saw an awful lot of flat buildings, roofs, empty. They don't even have HAV systems on or anything. That's just, I was like, oh, my God, what an opportunity. And I know some of you say, oh, we have bad weather here. Hello? Hello? How's the weather in Germany? Far worse than it is here. You know the biggest company or area in the world producing and installing solar panels? It was for 5 years Germany. Weather has something to do with it, but not totally. So what did Google do? Google says, okay, we've been a leader in some areas. That's a joke. Some area, a lot of areas. So what we've done is also had electric cars for our employees, and these are solar panels up here, so we're going to be able to get the energy to recharge our cars. Not a bad idea. Now, what would happen if you did that on the campus here? Kind of a challenge, right? Think about it. It can happen. Now, my God, it's too expensive. I'm willing to bet if you had a plan for your campus similar to some of these ideas, there would be people willing to not only invest but support and finance it. It's happened repeatedly all over the place, and it still can happen. In other words, that the issue is trying to come up with a plan, an idea, and begin to work with people in implementing it. I'm not saying to call Google about it, by the way, but they're a good example of how it can work. They're featured in one of my books, too, by the way, Google. Then we had another interesting situation. This is before a Fukushima explosion and all, but this is also a community and area in Japan that has been very concerned about environmental issues. And in doing so, what they've done is have a series of programs and financing mechanisms to make it happen in Japan. These, everybody, are solar roofs. Not just one home, but all of these, hundreds of homes. Now, ask yourself a question, because I did this, actually, with one of my clients. And the question was, if I bought one solar panel, it cost X. If I bought 10 solar panels, it cost Y. What if I bought 1,000 solar panels? And someone said to me, well, you mean, what are you going to do with 1,000 solar panels? I'm saying, I'm going to cover the roofs of this film studio. And I found a couple of vendors that said, okay, we'll give you a price which is very, very low. And we'll give that same price to all your employees. Now, I started thinking to myself, what if we did that with universities? What if we covered a lot of our roofs with solar panels, and then we said to you in your home, or your apartment building, or your office building, what if you were able to buy off of that master contract that was competitively bid for related groups of people who are on the campus? Does it make sense? Of course it does. And you get a number of companies that are willing to go and bid for this sort of thing, because from their point of view, it's good business. From your point of view, it's good for the environment, +++. All right? And I'm not talking about electric cars that will be plugged into your house or home or building either. So these are the kind of things that could happen, and in fact are happening in some other areas. So you have, as an example, the on-site power, as you can see here, in different homes or buildings or garages. It's not just on top of an office building. Then I wanted to just bring up real quickly that the economic model here, this is coming from a group or a company in New York called New World Economics or Capital, and they're just looking at what the kinds of market estimates are in these different areas. This is as of 2010, and it's actually grown considerably just in these different fields. There has been, as you can see, a critical factor in terms of government support in this. However, in recent years, it gets very politicized. So it's been, at least in the United States, it's been cut off quite a bit. So the so-called incentives and tax breaks have all been something that's been shortened. Then we get into where the future's going. These are some cars. This comes from Honda. This is a clean. There's a big difference between clean and green energy. Big difference, by the way. Okay. Then it has gasoline, electric, natural gas, and then hydrogen fuel cell. What's happened is the natural gas has gained more and more strength because the natural gas industry is pushing to get the refueling stations for these vehicles. But the future is probably going to be the hydrogen fuel cell car coming from renewable energy sources. Then this just looks at one of the other things that some students of mine at UCLA were looking at, and that is how you put together these systems into a smart grid where you're having wind and solar, but they're also being used as a charging system for electric vehicles and also for hydrogen fuel cells. This is actually from some colleagues of mine at General Motors, and they're now putting together a schematic to show when the phases will be for these different cars in the mass market being introduced in the United States and obviously here in Canada as well. And then we have, of course, the major issue, which is how we get around, whether it's by bicycle or refueling or electric hybrid or other kind of transportation. We don't need to have an SUV to go to the grocery store every day. Ridiculous. In America, we do that. Then this is the future from a Japanese company that I work with. And this company has, as you can see, an e-charged highway, solar systems right along both sides of it, wind turbines in the urban area, not just over here in the water or by the sea or out this direction. And you can see what happens. This is a young lady. She's reading her magazine with one hand and having her drink with the other. Because this is hooked up to this, and it moves along the highway using renewable energy sources. So I close with telling you this is the future. It's not that far away. And I'd urge all of you to take a look at it and think about it, change it, and get involved. And I close with this. This is me. when my son was 2 years old. And this is my son, and this is my grandson. Yes. I have two generations, the two young boys, related from two different families. It's their lives that I'm concerned about, and the reason I'm here. Because I want to encourage all of you to think about what you need to do now, to look at different technologies like fuel cells, how you can have fuel cells in terms of play toys that are for education. And this comes from a company in Singapore that distributes these all over the world as educational tools on how to use hydrogen fuel cells. This is how to reach me, and I want to thank you very much for your time and attention, questions and comments. Thank you.
So thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Hi, I wonder what...
Do you mind actually just saying your name and standing up for
Sorry,
a second?
Sorry, Jan Morgan. I live in Westmont. Yeah. I was wondering about your connection to Jeremy Rifkin, mm-hmm. who writes, talks about a great deal of the same sort of stuff and is doing most of his work in Europe.
Yeah. Jeremy and I are very close friends. We worked together for over a decade. We published papers together. We've actually done conferences and workshops, mostly in Europe. And more recently, he came out with a book called The Third Industrial Revolution. And I urged him to do that because in a book that he wrote on the European Dream, he talked about a third industrial revolution. And he and I had a little bit of a debate before his book came out because I was also finishing a book called The Third Industrial Revolution, which I'm cited in the introduction. So I decided, Jeremy, look, you and I are both friends. I don't want lawyers involved. It's going to cost us money and delay the publication. So I changed my book to be called Global Energy Innovation. And Jeremy came out with his book, The Third Industrial Revolution, which became a bestseller, as I understand it, online. But there's a big difference in what he and I do, though. I'm much more practical and down-to-earth. He tends to be much more of a visionary in many ways. The other thing is I really do feel very strongly that this is not just a European leadership model, that we are really seeing Asia. I have seen China leapfrog into this green, I call it the Green Industrial Revolution. So that's where he and I kind of have a bit of a difference. But in general, we talk about the same kinds of issues and ideas.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Kartik. I'm a grad student at McGill. It seems that in today's society, we sort of associate progress with wealth creation and sort of unlimited development. I was just wondering, in most natural systems, they only survive if they reach some sort of steady state or equilibrium. So I was wondering if you think that a green industrial revolution has to take into account steady state economics.
In a way, but it depends. As I said, I think economics is going through a paradigm change, a very dramatic one, and I think that's one of them. In other words, what we are seeing in the global recession right now is not a steady state at all. And in fact, it's almost every day, if there's a hiccup in Europe, it just goes around the world. Again, the world's round. So I would say we have to start thinking creatively on a new kind of economics, and it's not the old model. I'll give you one good example. I gave you one about, you know, the master contract for solar panels. All right, let me give you another one. I've been working with people in the United States, mostly in the banking area, but also in state legislators out of Sacramento. And it was an idea that I had talked with the California State Controller, John Chung, who's a close friend. And basically what I said was this: look, why don't we make the financing of buildings or in homes, the mortgage, if you will, also include energy efficiency and conservation like lighting, but also renewable energy like solar panels and solar systems or solar thermal heating and cooling. Why don't we just make that part of the mortgage? I mean, you know, our bathrooms are now part of our mortgage. The lighting is part of it. Our plumbing system is now part of what's in our buildings. Why not now, 50, 60 years later, include renewable energy? He loved the idea. So we had it going through the state legislature in California. I'm not kidding. I spent months working with people on this from Los Angeles and conference call, all the rest of it. It finally got to the place where a committee had to sign off of it in the state legislature, and they decided to table it. Table in America means they killed it. All right, which means now I have to go after their jobs. I have to get these people out of office. By the way, mostly Democrats, by the way. and that I really was upset. And so what we're now going to do is bring it back again, and we have support of the governor of California, Governor Brown, because it's a new way of looking at these kinds of issues, and not to get so caught up with either the steady state or what's got to exist in order for there to be a future. We've got to look at these things in different ways. Question from the dean.
Andrew
Kirk. Wait. In order to do this, I have to walk over here. All right.
So, Andrew Kirk, interim dean of engineering. So there was a very interesting article in the IEEE Spectrum magazine a couple of months ago, looking at renewable energy, and the argument it was making was they did an analysis of the time to market of various energy sources over the years, and saying that, you know, how many years did it take for an energy source to be 5% of the total energy market, how many for 50%, looking at coal, which took something like 200 years, I think, and then electricity took maybe 60, 100 years. And it said, well, if you have the same projections for renewable sources like solar or wind, you know, we're going to be waiting a long, long time. And I guess I wonder what your take on that was.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that question, partly because of the question that was just asked, and partly because I literally this afternoon I had some time, so I was reading Scientific American. I just get it online all the time. And in Scientific American, this today's issue is a whole big article about how wind is, like, so important, an enormous number of gigawatts of energy that can be produced around the world, and then cited different places where that's going to happen. And it is happening. So the question is, no, it's not going to take 50 or 100 years to have wind and solar and other, not at all. That's one reason I used the example from Denmark, because the Danes have been doing this in a relatively short period of time. The issue has to do with, are we going to take action on the planning process and provide the money and resources to do it? So that's where I take exception to the organization. I know the organization. I've given talks there, you know, very much over the years. But I also recognize there's a group which is like, we have a vested interest. Let's keep our vested interests, called our jobs. This is the money I got to send my kids to college. This is my home finance, and this is my summer home finance, and this is my two Cadillacs I don't drive all at the same time, but I need anyway. Right? So I understand how that works. Been there, done that, been through that, personally as well. My point to all of you is that that's not the future, and it's because of these kids. We have responsibility to them, and it's not going to be 100 years. And those of us, and I'm older than you are, I can tell from the hair color, although you're getting gray on the beard, but what I'm saying to you is that it's important that we do something, not wait and say, oh, it'll happen someday, you know, and pray to whoever you're praying to do it. No, it's got to happen now. It's our responsibility. And it is possible, that's what I'm saying. That brings up more questions.
You didn't quite talk about public...
And your name?
Anjan Mohan.
Okay.
You didn't quite talk about public transit systems and their role in sort of doing sustainability, because... My experience, I lived as a student in the U.S. for 2 years, and I know the dependence on the automobile is paramount. Mm-hmm. And public transit systems are really not good. Mm-hmm. Compared to what I see here in Canada, is all of us in Montreal are very dependent on the public transit system. That reduces dependence on the automobile. And so on and so forth. So could you talk about sustainable, you know, public transit systems and your views on that?
Well, I'm going to get to somewhere in my career a point where I say, okay, cut the cameras, I'm going to say something I don't want everybody to hear. But it's okay. People have heard this from me before. I live in a place called the United States, and I live specifically in Southern California. And Southern California is a developing nation. Are you with me? We have no train to the airport. We have very limited, if you will, small subway, just new, actually. And we used to have trains all over the place in Southern California. It is basically a desert, which means we've got to get our water from someplace. And it also is controlled by real estate interests. They then control the politicians, and they control what goes on. So what you have is a series of things that are... And by the way, I've been to West Africa, Burkina Faso, and I saw an amazing similarity between there, the second poorest nation in the world, and Los Angeles area, okay? Amazing. I could go on. you know, bike paths, the roads are dirty and messed up, you can't drive without having a flat tire, no walking places that are safe, it goes on and on. So my point to everybody is we have to do something about that. And the way I usually put it to people, including in West Africa, is you've got to leapfrog over these people who are stopping the future. And the way to do that is begin to show, like you were just suggesting, that there are transportation needs, mass transit needs, and others. However, I also want to be sure that we're including concepts like regenerative braking for trains, maglev trains, and other kinds of systems that are going to be more efficient and faster. And that's something that's going to take some time and effort in California, let alone in the United States. We have no high-speed rail in the United States. I mean, they call it a high-speed rail from Washington, D.C. to Boston. I can go faster riding my bike than that train goes, okay? I mean, it's kind of foolish. And that's the sort of thing that we have to change, not just in the United States, but around the world. What I'm noticing is you're seeing more of these changes going on in Europe and also in Asia, particularly in China. And so in some respects, we have to start working with people in other parts of the world to get these systems in our country or in our regions.
My name is Frank. I came here because sustainability was written in the document. I said, well, because we've been trying to get... Queen's University has a department called Mining and Sustainability. So mining is my field.
Okay.
I remember in asbestos we were... trying to get the magnesium out of the tailings.
Mm-hmm.
It's been $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the price was $125 in China.
Mm-hmm.
They lowered it to $75 and bankrupted the company.
Yeah.
And that's going in many, many examples of that. So I was in Shanghai going to the airport. I think it was Beijing. 7 minutes to go by, going 0 to 400 kilometers an hour and down.
Mm-hmm.
It's made by Siemens, though.
It's right
there exposed to you. So
Everybody
sees it in China.
Right.
So the question I'm asking is really, you haven't gone underground here. What about geothermal, a whole subdivision, and putting a commercial geothermal plant and heating all those houses with hundreds of thousands? Nobody's done that I know of. That's just one example. And of course, you never mentioned uranium.
Yeah.
I'm an older uranium miner, nuclear power plants, but nobody's ever died in a nuclear power plant. I don't know what you're scared of.
Nuclear power?
Nobody's ever died in a nuclear power plant. Even Chernobyl, the moderator was graphite and caught fire.
Yeah, right.
Everybody burned to death, but they didn't catch fire.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you know what's the matter with identifying the underground thing too?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that would be a long answer, but let me just try to cut to the couple of things. Geothermal. There's more and more research as well as communities starting to do more and more of that. I know in the United States, particularly in the Illinois, Indiana, Ohio areas, which is not far from here, they're doing a lot of it. You can't do it really effectively in Southern California because, again, the desert, you don't have the ground to do it in. However, I think you're right. It's a very important technology. I know they're also doing a lot of it in Europe as well. So it's a very strong thing to do. In terms of nuclear power, let me be very honest and blunt about it. When I was at Lawrence Livermore Lab, one of the big issues was, of course, what do you do with the waste? Because we're responsible at the laboratory for the waste. And I'm a very good friend of mine, electrical engineer there, was in charge of this at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And the conclusion was, we don't know. The scientific conclusion was, we don't know. We're going to try. But then when they found water in Yucca Mountain and they found other problems, that wasn't the solution. So what do you do with it? How do you get it from point A to point B is an issue. And one that I've seen and been in France several times and asking the French that, they never have an answer. 80% of their power is coming from nuclear power, but it's still an issue with the waste. What I was trying to point out in the slide is what people don't often talk about is how much uranium is left. Okay? Now that's an issue because then it gets to a question of where that's going to come from. And if there's only a limited amount of it, then there's going to have to think about different things that we need to do. So it gets into some very complicated issues. In terms of you're saying people haven't died from, like in Chernobyl, there have been hundreds of people who were sick from the aftermath of all of that and who died subsequently later from different kinds of cancer and other diseases. But I don't want to get into all the problems with it. I just think it's a very, very unknown, difficult, and still needs dozens of years, if not more, for research. And I know you want to talk more, but let's let other people...
Uranium up another 400 years. So don't say there's a shortage of uranium.
Well, I'm just going by numbers that I have been given from the U.S. Department of Energy. It's not my numbers.
Hi, my name is Laura. Just quick comment first about the geothermal. One of the issues is that apparently like a well will only last for about 50 years, after which it becomes useless and you have to dig a new one. So from that perspective, might not be the best. But my question was just, politically speaking, whose responsibility do you think it is to make all these changes? Would it be more on a consumer level for the producers or for the government to start all these green initiatives?
Well, this is where in my book that's coming out, The Next Economics, I make it very clear. I think it's the government. It's got to be able to say, here's the plan, here's what we're going to do, plus here's the money. Not a credit card, not a loan necessarily, but actual cash to do it. And I refer to that as social capitalism. That's what it has to be. Because capitalism in and of itself, which puts essentially everything in the if you will, the demand or consumer side, there's supposed to be a balance between those, is a false mythology that has been promoted for a couple hundred years from Adam Smith. And it's been shown that doesn't work. The issue that has worked over the last several hundred years, and particularly in the last decade or century, has been how government has actually started oil and gas and these other kind of industries because they've actually made decisions to let the land be used for those purposes. And I think that, you know, fast forward, that's what we have to begin to do too. We just can't say, oh, the market will do it. There's no way that's going to happen. I mean, if you really look at it, how did Apple Computer start? Well, did it start from a government grant? No. But as I pointed out, a research lab that had invented computer technology, they had government subsidy, by the way, at the time, like 20, 30 years ago, and that was what Steve Jobs did in terms of finding the technology to make his Apple computers. That's the same kind of thing that happened. Does everybody know how Microsoft started? Same thing. They had a government grant because Bill Gates' mother was on the board of a corporation that had direct involvement with the U.S. government. They got a grant from the U.S. government to start Microsoft years ago, a couple of decades ago. So, hello, it's not the market. You know, it doesn't work like that. Someone?
Hi.
Oh, I see. Sorry. I saw somebody raise their hand in the back. Sorry.
No, I'm Cameron Butler. You talk a lot about the need for cross-disciplinary solutions and connecting the different disciplines. And you talk a lot about the environmental, technological, and economic sides of things, but you haven't gone a lot into like the social sustainability sides and the issues of things like systems of oppression or poverty or those kinds of topics that need to be dealt with to actually create sustainable societies. And I was wondering if you could go more into that.
I do that in my books and other things, so I get into those kinds of issues, including women's issues, which is a whole other thing. In answer to your question, I think those are all very important things. Essentially, what I've tried to do in my own work and research is refer to them as externalities, so that when we look at issues of, you know, how you have renewable energy and where the cost comes from, we've got to also look at what the impact is, the positive impact on health and reducing, you know, lung cancer and other kind of things starting from, you know, coming from emissions of cars and vehicles. That also has to do with social communities. We don't have to have communities that are so spread apart that the only way you can get around is by a car and freeway and highway, which is what Los Angeles has. We have communities that are much more focused and together with people different, you know, living in buildings, not necessarily all their big estates, but all in one area. And that gets in the infrastructure issues and stuff that I pointed out. The other part that you didn't mention, but, you know, what about the older folks, those retiring, you know, perhaps your parents and others? What are they going to do? You know, where are they going to live? Where is it going to be not only environmentally friendly, but also rather important for their lifestyles in the communities that they live in? And I don't know, does anybody in the room ever watch a program called Steinfeld, Jerry Steinfeld? Everybody see that? It's something that came out in the 90s, and they're repeating it a lot in America. And he has in that his family that retired to Florida. And every time I see that show, it cracks me up because there's things that you can all identify with that he's going through with what his family is doing in retirement. They don't talk about the environment. They don't talk about solar panels. You know, this is 20 years ago. But they do bring up issues that are important as to how families relate and how they work together or can work together. So that's important. Where are they going to live? Retirement communities is an example. So I've done work in this area. I brought up a little of it here, but not as much as you point out, but it's extremely important, and I totally agree with what you're saying.
Good evening. François Richard. I'm working at Pratt & Whitney Canada in sustainable development. Thank you. A very interesting presentation. One thing that strikes me in the recent years is in the last 10, 15 years, we've seen like the very rapid and massive deployment of cell phones. And the business model associated with it was quite interesting in the sense where even though it was an expensive technology, the business gave it to you and you bought the service instead. Mm-hmm. And I find that from all the new technologies that we're seeing, a lot, the problem that we see is the introduction. You know, it's, I already have a car. Why should I buy an electric car? I've already got a heating system. Why should I buy a solar heating system? And the proof of that is that we see in emerging countries that they go straight to the latest because they don't have to buy the 1960 stuff. Do you see an opportunity in terms of business model? And I think you mentioned something about it, where instead of, you know, I need hot water in my house, I don't need a water boiler. Mm-hmm. Can I just get the hot water? You know, can I go straight for the service and then afford the more energy efficient technologies?
You probably can. I mean, right off the top of my head, I like taking hot water. I can't think of an example of that. But going back to your cell phone example, remember I mentioned I was in Burkina Faso, and there's an example of what I think you were referring to. Here, people wanted to have telephones and communication, you know. So their answer was, okay, do we, you know, drill these massive tunnels and wiring and poles and the rest of it? No, they went into the Wi-Fi, the essentially wireless mode. And then that you walk around in that country, again, like Los Angeles, everybody's got a cell phone. And they're walking around. They're walking across the street. They don't care if a car is coming or not. They're on their cell phone. So you almost see them in other places of the world, like you were saying, leapfrogging into these kinds of technologies, not just going along with what happened. Now, do all of you know, I know most of you here probably have cell phones, but I think most of you also have, you know, like a wireless headset for music or something like that. Everybody's probably got one, right? You're walking to work, you're going on your bicycle someplace, you're not always on the phone, you're listening to music. Does everybody know where that came from? Okay, it's, again, out of the box thinking. Came from the Japanese, and they invented in a company called Sony the original, which turned into like the Walkman it was called, in which you would walk around and have these things. Do you know how it happened? The two men who created the company initially, one of them was in New York City, the story goes, about 30 years ago, and he was walking from one meeting to the other, and he's going down the street, and this guy has got this big, what they used to call boombox, walking down the street, louder than anything. It was like all over the street. It wasn't just in him, right? So what this fellow, the Japanese engineer, decided is, what if we had something that we could have our own private music in our ears and didn't interfere with other people? And that's how it happened. I mean, did he do a study, a survey, look at what the market is, who else has got it? No, nothing at all like that. Now, since then, of course, we've had all kinds of imitations, if you will, and most of you probably know that Apple Computer just settled one with Samsung, you know, the South Korean company, for $1 billion. And there's, you know, that kind of discussion. It's a lot of money. It's the biggest settlement ever. But the point is you can have these new ideas and try them. The one that you were talking about, water, hot water at home and all, there's some possibilities that I've heard of about doing that. But, of course, it's an issue about the water and the cost to heat it. You know, where's all that going to come from? So I actually know some college campuses that have solar thermal systems for heating their pools and the hot water from the solar from the rooftops. And I think in China they actually have some for homes and buildings too. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is David Brown. I'm with the School of Urban Planning here at McGill. Sorry.
Okay. Nice. I want people to see you. No, all right.
All right,
recognized? I'll sit down. You can. No.
David Brown, the School of Urban Planning at McGill. Very interesting talk about the technologies in particular for promoting sustainable communities and having the energy and so on that we need to run them. We in planning talk about another angle on all of this, which is really trying to lower the transportation demand, right, have more accessible communities, move from words like mobility to accessibility, promote active transportation. And I'm wondering where you would, what you feel about that, what you think about the possibilities, really. I think we see in some states, some cities in the states, mm-hmm, that there are actually people who are interested going back into the city center, creating a renaissance, as it were, in the mm-hmm city, which actually is very good in that respect in terms of reducing the travel demand, reducing the need for cars altogether.
Right, right.
Is there a hope for us?
Well, I'm of the same feeling. I very strongly believe in what you're just saying about the trouble, frankly, in our society as it's grown. Everything's grown out, you know. And I think that that's one of the things I was trying to point out with China as well. As Chinese economy grew, everybody's headed to the East Coast or their East Coast area. So what they're trying to do is reverse that. And I think that's part of what you're talking about. We've had communities, you know, just sort of, I mean, Los Angeles is a classic example, just spread all over the place. So we have huge buildings in downtown, other big buildings in other places. But it's only been in the last 5 or 6 years that actually Los Angeles has had a turnaround. They've got people now going back into downtown Los Angeles. They're actually buying condos and buildings there to live in. And there's also now new buildings that are being done there. So people can live and work and walk around to different places, not have to go and commute on a car. You don't have subways in Los Angeles to go by train, so or by subway. So you have to go by car. Almost everybody, it's a massive problem. So I totally agree with that for the environmental reasons, but also for just simply the convenience reason and on the health reasons. I mean, we walked around campus today. I got more of a track running with Giza than I. He was going and showing me all the different places and buildings, and I actually had to say to him, listen, I got to rest for a minute here. But part of it's because I have a bad knee. But aside from that, the thing is that we need to do more of it. We need to do more walking, use bicycles and other things that are friendly to the environment versus not. Now, would someone say, oh, what's that going to do to the XYZ industry? And that, well, it's going to help the bicycle industry. It's going to do some other. Anyone ever ride an electric bicycle, by the way? Anyone ever been on an electric bike? I tried. There's a Japanese company that makes electric bikes. It's fascinating. But sometimes you have trouble getting up those hills, you know. So and it has regenerative braking, so if you break it going down, it's... Anyway, so the point is that there are these things that can happen and are happening in other parts of the world, and what we've got to do is bring them back, you know, into our communities and make them sustainable by just doing this sort of thing. I totally agree with you.
Thank you very much. I'll take one last question.
Well, we have to have Ram introduced me. At least have one question, right?
You want a question? Yeah. I'll ask.
All right, okay. You'll be the last question.
So you'll have the last.
My name is John Dory. I think there's a lot of hocus-pocus about some of these green things. For instance, if you compare an efficient turbocharged diesel with a hybrid car, the diesel would last a lot longer. There's a carbon footprint to make the cars, so a car that hasn't got as long a life, you have to reproduce it again with using more energy. And the weight of the car also reduces the efficiency, so a hybrid car carrying electric motors and a battery, which is heavy, is not as efficient from the point of view of moving it around.
You were the one that wrote the questions, were you?
Did you
have the page of questions you gave
me
as well?
You compare diesels with hybrid cars. You compared gasoline cars.
No. I'll take exception with you on the diesel if you want. We can debate it, but I totally disagree with what you just said. I have a hybrid Prius. It has over 110,000 miles on it. I get about 45 miles to a gallon. And they now have Priuses that have actually solar panels for recharging them, so you don't have to even have any kind of gasoline at all. They're all electric. So the question becomes, you know, which is more efficient, which is more better to use? Have you ever driven, for example, a hydrogen fuel cell car or an all-electric car? It's like driving a race car. You put your, you take off. Third thing, okay, after those two, the technology. The combustion engine compared to an electric engine, much more efficient, much more easy to use, maintain, repair, and change. And more importantly, is it something that doesn't require fossil fuels of any kind.
And what is the life of the battery?
The life of a battery, in my case, I've had my car 8 years, never done anything with it, so it's still there. Works like a charm. Case closed, right? Any more?
Auto technicians tell me the batteries don't last that long.
That's because they're trying to sell you a new battery. My battery's got 10 years on it, you know? What can I tell you? I'm, if you will, a case study of that whole thing. I appreciate your question, but didn't you write me a bunch of other questions? Was that you that had some questions earlier? Was that from? You had a list, yeah. Because you had another question on there. Actually, two other questions were interesting on this list. This is from you, right?
Yes, go ahead.
This is yours? Yeah.
Pick one.
No, okay, no. The other question you had on here is about, you talked about intermittency, or I would talk about intermittency. In other words, the sun and the solar is not always there. So it's called intermittent power. The what? That's true, but they still work, i.e. Germany. I mean, they... Well, yeah, right, right. But the point I was trying to make is that you're right in the question asking, and the point is the solar and the wind are not always there. The sun's not there. What I was trying to say in part of my presentation is this is where we have to see how we can integrate these systems. So, for example, in Southern California, we have these huge wind farms, all these wind turbines, and one of the things I've been trying to do is work with the public utilities to have rows in between them of solar, so that you have the solar and the wind using the same transmission lines, which is efficient and good for the environment, but at different times of the day. So it works out. In other words, you combine the power sources. Oh, they're definitely meeting peak demand. The sun usually is out during the daytime. This is in a desert area, so that means, you know, during the day and evenings you've got at least the sun till that time. Then you pick up with the wind until about 2 o'clock in the morning. You've met it. I can show you the data if you like, then we can share the information. So what I'm saying is you have to always ask the questions. Where's the data? Where's the information? Where's the proof? And so that's what I try to do. I've got information. I can share it with you about all of that. So we have one last question.
Well, it's my privilege to have the last question. Mine is actually a real dilemma. Not technologic, actually. It's more economic and policy. If I look at the macro picture, we have this enormous fossil resource that was built up with the aid of sun over millions of years, and which we started using up only after the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And now we're already facing, and that has not been a long period when you look at in relation to the period of human history. And we're now looking at a sense of finiteness, which is 2 generations, 5 generations, 4 generations. We're really looking at stark termination of our human species. Mm-hmm. So on the other side, we have these enormous potentials where we could take the world from a total fossil fuel dependence to a total renewable energy use. Mm-hmm. The real question to ask is, what is the total investment that would take us from going that point to this point, whether it comes from public or private capital, whether we have it, or how long will it take to make the transformation, and where would regulation, policy, and rationing fit in? Mm-hmm. Because I can't see if we are going to be a free consumers that are always looking for resource and expect it to be available, mm-hmm. and not treat energy as a communal resource where there has to be some sort of rationing at some point fairly mm-hmm. quickly, I do not see how we are going to get to the other side. Mm-hmm. That's a huge dilemma in my
mind. Yeah. The answer, I guess, is I personally do not have an answer to the, you know, how much does it cost or how big the check has to be. And I say that because I've been asked the question, but I do know there are some people who try to look at those numbers. And my feeling about it is it's all just guessing, because I don't think anybody really knows. I know that not only a few years ago, but even 10 years ago, the cost for solar panels was one thing. Today it's much less. The idea of a solar panel is, and I've shown pictures of it, are these large systems that you have to put on top of a roof, which means the structure of the roof has got to be redone and solid to hold it. Well, they now have solar panels that are what they call thin film. They're like that thin. And you put them on as a roof. Take off the regular roof or put it on top of your current roof. It just acts as a roof. It's not something that needs a heavy system for construction. So all of this is changing. Then some people say to me, well, if it's changing, why should I do this today when next year or 2 years from now it's all going to be different or whatever? So you get in those kinds of questions all the time, those kinds of issues, and I don't think there's any really answer to it. I think the main answer, though, is whether or not the society or government or our leaders take a step and say, okay, this has to be done. We've got to provide financial resources, support our technology, and begin to see how we're going to collaborate business and industry with the government together. That, I think, is the basic question, the answer. What does it cost? What's going to happen? I don't know. But if you look at the history of economics and public policy, it's been done before. It's been done in America. It's been done here in Canada before. It's being done in other parts of the world now. We have, unfortunately, over the last three or four decades, as the economists pointed out at one point, we've grown to the point where we've said, no more government, just the market. Thank you, Governor Reagan, President Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, for giving us all this insight into stupidity. That's what it is. because that's not the way the world's worked, nor has it been successful in the way that they were talking about. They will claim, oh, we had this great economic growth and this and that because the market and the private sector did this and did that, and this was deregulated and all the rest. I am here today to tell you, I was right there in the bowels of deregulation in California, and it was not successful. It was the dumbest thing that's ever happened, at least in California. I know it also in Europe. So the point I'm trying to make is we have to look at what does work. What is the cost to what all this is? I don't really know. I do know, though, again, the Chinese actually put some real money into it in their current five-year plan, the 12th one. And that's, trillions of dollars. That's important. Are we able to do that in America? I don't think so. Are you able to do it here in Canada or in Quebec or Montreal? I don't think so. So we've got to figure out some ways to do this. That's why I mentioned some other economic models like warrants and some other things that you can have, with financing. So I don't really have the answer. Sorry. I'll come back and give you an answer sometime.
Okay. So I guess my duty as Dean of Engineering is just to thank Dr. Clark for this very exciting talk, very exciting and wide-ranging talk, I'd say, sharing a vision of the green industrial revolution. And I think we're very fortunate to have someone here who can act as the translator between science and social sciences. In fact, I just wanted to see a quick show of hands. How many people would classify themselves as a scientist or engineer? And how many social scientists? A few. Okay, so we do have some engagement between the two communities, which is great. And exactly the sort of discussion we wanted to have when we set up the Institute for Sustainability in Engineering and Design. And in fact, we're going to be announcing in November a very exciting expansion to the Institute, which is really going to move it further into the public policy direction and public discussion as well. And so just in terms of the talk, I think over the years we've seen, many visions for green cities and sustainability, but here Dr. Clark's shown us that people around the world are really making things happen now, and that, it's now the time for implementation, for leadership, and that leadership is coming from places that you wouldn't necessarily expect it to come from, and perhaps not enough from here in North America, and that energy independence can be realized, although I think, there are many questions still as to how you realize it in the details, but, the big picture is there. And I think some of the takeaway lessons are that we need planning and leadership. We need a holistic vision for integrated communities. We need to have smarts. We need to have smart grids, smart cities, smart people, smart businesses, and smart governments. And the clusters make sense. We talked about the science park in Aalborg. And in fact, interestingly, in the latest QS World University rankings in electrical and computer engineering, which is my area, if you look at which university electrical engineering department had the highest number of citations per professor, it wasn't MIT, it wasn't a U.S. university, it was actually Aalborg University.
Oh, I had the highest
number of citations. Huh. So people are reading what they write. Dr. Clark talked about the critical relationship between engineers and business people to make things happen. And again, that's what we want to see in ICED here, that it's very important to ask questions and, always question what's happening. And I think the message to the students here is that it's really, it's going to be your responsibility to try and make this work. And that, once you go out and graduate and get jobs, you're going to be the people who are really going to make this happen. And we need you to do this. And that we can no longer rely on business as usual. So I think I'd just like to finish by thanking Dr. Clark for this great talk. And thanks for coming to Montreal. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.